Well, I would like to offer a talk today that has three parts. The first part is maybe the simplest part, and that way maybe the most profound part, and that is to offer you a simple slogan, a Dharma phrase that from the Buddha that is a kind of a useful phrase to memorize and to carry with you and question and use it as a lens to explore your experience and to argue with and to be inspired by, to be challenged by, to help you understand yourself better. So the first is to offer you the slogan. The second is to offer you a condensation of practice instruction for meditation that the Buddha gave that is in a very simple three-part process. Do A, do B, do C. Boom. Very nice. It's very simple, and it's applicable in many different circumstances. And the third part of the talk was that I'm going to elaborate on where this simple condensation comes from. A particular sutta, particular direct instructions he gave called Anapanasati, the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, which I think is quite a meaningful description of how practice can unfold or meaningful way of lenses in which to look upon our practice. And I don't offer that in this part, these 16 steps, not only do you not have to memorize them, but you also don't have to anticipate them, but you're going to get bogged down by going through 16 steps as we go through here. So, you know, you can stay. Don't turn off yet. And but the 16 steps, I think, are, you might find yourself at some points that where these perspectives of these different steps are relevant for you, and the instructions that are given might be useful. And it's also helpful to understand that through a variety of different ways, Buddhism, the Buddha's teachings, involves a path. He often called it a gradual path, and sometimes he likened it to the deepening of the water under the ground, under the ocean. It's in some places in India, I guess, it deepens slowly. The water goes, and so you know you can walk out and go slowly, get deeper and deeper. And I think it's something very mature about having a long-term view of practice and be in it for the long term to allow for the slow maturation of personal qualities, maturation of insight and concentration. And there's so many different factors that mature within us as part of a full, rounded Dharma practice. That it's good to just kind of have a semi-inspired by the idea that yeah, there is a path or a variety of paths, different ways of understanding it, and it's a really good one, and it's something we can all walk. And partly I offer it that way so that we don't think that there's kind of this magic thinking around practice, right? That if there's just this magic button, if you just find that button inside, you can push that button and boom, the Big Bang Theory of Enlightenment. Then you'll be happy ever after, and that's it. And just, it'd be nice just to get it over with, right? There's important things to do in life, and, you know, spending all this time practicing is, you know, you could do other things. I mean, gee. So I think there's something very mature about seeing it as a process, as a path. And so I offer this partly as a different model of the unfolding, a little bit different than the jhana description Lee did yesterday, but I think in harmony with it, and some people say it's the same thing, just from a different perspective. But and it ends with insight, which is a nice to point out. So three parts of the talk, slogan, three simple practices, and then this description of the path. Okay. So the slogan, I think sometimes the Buddha was able to say very profound things sometimes while kind of pulling people's legs, kind of maybe humorous. In ancient India, there was the idea at his time that if you were a great spiritual teacher, realized person, you were omniscient. Omniscient, really omniscient, you know, like you, past, future, everything you just knew. And many centuries after the Buddha died, he became omniscient like that, at least by the tradition. But in the early suttas, in the early tradition, he does claim that he's omniscient. So this is where he's kind of a little bit, I think, kind of playing around a little bit. But then he's omniscient this way. He knows something important about everything. So like the common denominator. So everything that possibly you could know in the universe, he knows something about it. And this is what he knows. Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. That's how he's omniscient. Isn't that great? And that's the Dharma slogan. Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. You don't have to agree to that slogan. In fact, if you don't agree with it, it's the slogan for you. Because you can engage in it, you can question it, you can question yourself, you can use it as a mirror to understand why you don't believe in it, why you believe it's worth clinging to. What do you think is worth clinging to? You might have really good beliefs, you know, and you could kind of flush them out, you know, these hard and deeply ingrained ideas of the absolute necessity of clinging to certain things. And where did you get that idea? Where did you learn that? Why? What's going on with that? Is there another side? And then to kind of stretch yourself, you know, could it be that maybe I don't? And in what circumstances don't I have to cling to what I think I need to cling to? That's an interesting question. In what circumstances am I willing to put down the things that I cling to as most essential for me? Because maybe if you ask that question, you know, in what circumstances, then maybe from time to time you can find those circumstances and have a vacation from your clinging. But if you're here, you're not supposed to cling to anything, I'll just drop it completely. That can be too big of a task. But are there some places you can give up clinging? And perhaps it's inspiring, this idea. It shows you a potential, a possibility of freedom, of peace, that is unparalleled, because clinging is a source of agitation. Clinging is a source of unease. Clinging is a source of stress. So without any clinging, the heart is at home in itself. And what a nice thing to have the heart at home in itself. So you might think about this, nothing whatsoever worth clinging to. It's a wonderful, wonderful kind of direction, understanding. And it's also a protection as you go through the Dharma practice. Because, you know, the Dharma is meant to free us from suffering, not to cause us more suffering. And not a few Buddhist, I think probably every Buddhist practitioner sooner or later suffers because of this path of freedom from suffering. It's a little bit paradoxical, right? But you know, because it's so important for many of us, things are really important, then we so easily want to kind of hold on to it in the ways. But so it's a protection. Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. I think, isn't there a sign in the kitchen that says something from Suzuki Roshi? It says something like, what does it say? It's
so important, don't take it too seriously.
What's not so important?
What we are doing.
Yeah, what we're doing is so important. It's too important to take seriously. Isn't that great? This non-clinging is so important. Don't cling to it. So that's the first part. So the second part of the talk is these three steps of practice. Three things you can do. So the first is recognize what's happening. So just recognize the basic mindfulness. Recognize what's happening at the present moment. Wake up, be present, and what's happening here? Look around. Feel around. And you look around in your mind, in your heart, your body, and the world around you. Just recognize what's happening. It's not meant to be some very complicated analysis or deep deep, penetrating analysis or investigation. Just recognize what's happening, what's obvious. Just recognize what's happening. The second is feel it. So don't just recognize it, don't just know it kind of from the cognitive mind, just kind of looking at it and know it that way. But really, let it register fully what this experience is like. Feel it in your marrow, in your bones. Just let it register deeply what it is. So I mean, a simple example, when I was in Burma, I was meditating for months on end in this little room, in a building, for kind of a dormitory building where Westerners lived in. And is it not loud enough? Can people hear okay? You're okay, that's better? Okay. So everybody else is okay with the sound? So I was there during the monsoon. And the way the monsoon worked was that I'd be sitting, minding my own business, meditating. And suddenly, out of the blue, there would be this torrential downpour. It was like someone just turned the switch on, and it wasn't just like a drizzle first, and it got stronger and stronger. It was like, and it wasn't like heavy rain. I mean, the expression "rain cats and dogs" doesn't say what it was like. It was like a river coming out of the sky. It was, I'd never seen anything like the amount of water that can come. As soon as I recognized that the rain had begun, it was beating down on the tin roof, I would immediately feel my way into it. I tune into my body, with my body kind of feel, what has shifted? Has anything shifted now? The atmospheric pressure, the humidity. I didn't have a particular idea of what it had to be, but I was just like, what's this like? So I wasn't just listening to it, it's like tuning in with my whole body. What's this like? To really feel and be present for it. And so to do that with all kinds of things, you can do it with the things that are challenging for you. Recognize it first, and then take the time to feel it and be with it. At the risk of saying too much, there is another little slogan I like, which is, gaze upon it kindly and be still. So whatever is going on, like if you have something's challenging, your thinking mind, your emotions, your pain, look upon it kindly and be still. Be still. Let it be. So the second step, so first recognize, and once you've recognized it, take the time to feel it. And one of the nice things about doing this is that it's good not to be in a hurry when you do Dharma practice. And when I was introduced to mindfulness, and it's kind of just mostly a recognition practice, sometimes I fall into the checklist approach. You know, I was kind of in a hurry to get somewhere, I don't know where, just kind of check off that, and noted that, aware of that. And kind of I'm ready, you know, once I recognize it, I'm on ready for the next thing. But to recognize what's there and then really feel it, be present for it, sometimes even savor it. Sense it and kind of let it, what is it like? And that's also a way of helping you not react to it, not push it away, not hold on to it, and really understand more deeply what's happening. There's a lot of information that's available to us in the kinesthetic, lived experience, the fullness of who we are, that's not available if we're only thinking about things. The cognitive side is limited pieces of information about what's going on in our life. So it slows things down, we kind of take our time to feel, trust what's happening, let things unfold, feel it. And this can also be true like when you focus on your breath in meditation. I've done the checklist approach to being with the breath, kind of like in, out, you know, just kind of feeling it from a distance and just kind of recognizing it. And there's a world of difference between that and feeling, sensing, savoring, resting, abiding in the experience of breathing. And sometimes people imagine the breath is like, breathing is like waves, and you're kind of floating on the waves going up and down, and really sensing, what's it like to kind of rest, like floating with your whole body on the experience of breathing in and out. But really sense and feel. And also that helps sometimes not to stray, not to be trying to look with the inner eye. Some people, you might check this out when you're trying to stay with something like the breath. Your eyes are closed. And see if your eyes are engaged. Some people are kind of, even with their eyes closed, are kind of looking, almost like they're leaning forward and kind of looking, and as if they can see with their physical eye. And that's kind of extra effort, it's not needed. And so this idea of feeling the experience, feeling the breath, can be for some people an antidote to this excessive kind of idea of using the mental eye to look and strain. So feel it, settle back, be with it. So recognize, feel, and then the third step is relax. Isn't that nice? Probably don't need to say anything more. Recognize, feel, relax. Recognize, feel, and release. Release is a little bit more than relax. It's kind of like let go of the grip, if you can. But if you can't let go of the grip, relax a little bit. So take your time. Don't be in a hurry to relax. Wait. Take the time to recognize and to feel. Hang out with something to get to know it. And when you kind of know it, then see if you can take a deep breath and relax. Soften around it. Soften what is. Soften into it more deeply. So, you know, even with the breath, you can recognize your breathing, you can feel it more fully, and then sometimes it's possible to relax with the breath. I like to relax with the exhale sometimes. It's kind of a letting go, and I kind of let go more fully. Kind of release the body. Some people brace their body, are braced against life, and to have a sense that the whole body can release, soften a little bit, or particular parts of the body can soften. An interesting exercise around breathing is at the end of the exhale, very gently, in a relaxed way, see if you can relax a bit more, let go a little bit more at the exhale, and see if the exhale on its own will go a little bit further. And the same thing with the inhale. When you get to the top of the inhale, and it kind of relax and see if naturally the inhale becomes a little bigger. Like your body relaxes and receives the inhale, and it kind of fills you a little bit more. And you don't make any effort to breathe. Exhale longer or inhale longer, but just kind of by relaxing sometimes. Or relax the belly when you're breathing is a nice thing to do. Or relax the eyes if you're looking. What is it? So the idea of feeling your way in to the experience sometimes can show you where the tension is, where the extra effort of holding is, and then you can maybe relax it. So I think that's a nice, you know, nice, simple, basic mindfulness instruction. Recognize, feel, and relax. And this simple instruction now comes from the discourse on the mind, Anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing. And here are 16 stages, 16 steps to practicing with the breath in the background or foreground, or staying with the breath, being with the breath. And as we stay with the breath, keeping the breath going, being aware on the side, kind of like doing two things at once, that other aspects of your experience. So you're filling it out and noticing what's happening as you primarily stay with the breath, breathing in, breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, one knows other things. So the first thing is to feel your body. Tune into your body. As you're breathing, what's going on in your body? The coarsest experience in your body might be the movements of the body as it breathes. So you might feel all the various movements in the body as you're breathing in, breathing out, feeling, you know, the rib cage expanding, contracting, the belly, the shoulders lifting. It can be fun sometimes to tune into the back rib cages moving back there. It's a little more harder, they don't move as much, and maybe not as much nerves back there maybe or something, but you can still feel it there. And some people find it very interesting to tune into the breath and the back, in their back rather than the front, because there's less control in the back. And some people are controlling their breath. It's, you know, they're more easily tied up in control if they're watching the breath in the front, but so watch, tune into the back. It's kind of can be nice sometimes. The Or you can be aware, or just look around the body. Do a quick body scan, or just kind of tune in to what's happening in your body. Being grounded and centered in the body is a very important part of Buddhist practice. I can't underscore the importance of being centered, grounded in your body. It's kind of like the body is like the base of a mountain or base of a pyramid that keeps it stable and strong and doesn't get pushed over by the wind easily because it has this kind of stability of being grounded. And so, you know, feel the body. And then the instructions are, relax the body. Imagine the Buddha said that. That was the instruction, right, from the Buddha. Relax. Take your time to relax, soften. Usually in English, the translation is tranquilize, make tranquil your body. But relax in ordinary English. You don't want to make a big project of this because there's no end to relaxing. And you can be neurotic about it and get yourself all worked up about relaxing. And to make too much of a project of it. But a little bit, you know, it's good to check in and notice. And periodically, like I found that if I really get focused and concentrated, and like I'm getting absorbed in the breath or something else, and I've been there for quite a while, for some time, I find it useful to pull out of that concentrated state and look around, you know, not literally, but kind of feel around to what's going on to see if there's something useful to notice that I had been ignoring because I had kind of blinders on, I was just focusing. And in particular, I might notice, am I straining too much? Am I tense? Am I tightening up? Are there some beliefs or some emotions, something going on that I just need to check in with and let go of so I can then kind of dip back in and get focused again? It's kind of a check and balance process. So breathe, feel the body, get to know the body, and then relax the body. Sometimes as the body begins to relax and to soften, there's a release of energy, release of kind of good feelings, sense of flowing. You know, it's kind of like if you held your hand in a fist for a really, really, really long time, so much that, you know, it kind of almost went numb or something, and then you finally release the grip, can feel really good. You feel this energy, the flow of blood goes in nicely, and it's like suddenly it's, I don't know, it's loosening up, and it just feels this aliveness. It feels light, lighter maybe, and it feels good. So as the whole body begins to soften, a lot of that energy that was used in being tense gets released. And so there tends to be a feeling of lightness, ease, softening. And I think part of the reason why some of this pamoja, some of this gladness arises, is because we freed up this energy that comes from being caught up in the hindrances or tension or whatever it might be. And in fact, that's the next instruction in this 16 steps, is to start tuning in, it says, to piti and sukha, to joy and to rapture. I mean, joy or rapture, and then, or sukha, happiness. But, you know, we could also take it much more simply, rather than technical terms. Tune into delight, to the sense of well-being. Whatever kind of well-being that comes, recognize the well-being. Recognize what feels good, what feels right. I might have said this, that, you know, for many years I was practicing, and I kind of thought that it was practices about being really serious. And serious is close to being grim. And feeling, having well-being and joy, I mean, you're not really serious then. You're not properly grim. And so, you know, I wouldn't pay any attention to it. I would just ignore it, you know, I had more important things to do. And it took me a while to learn that it's actually fine. It's allowable. These are allowables. It's allowable to feel good, to have happiness and joy and delight and have a sense of well-being. Can you imagine that that's allowed? One of the great privileges I had as a teacher, it just kind of struck me at the time, was you know, every once in a while I'll rise myself up to my full authoritative stature as a senior Dharma teacher and really kind of lay into people that this is what's going on. So watch out, you guys. And so this was such a privilege. There was a woman who came out of a religious tradition that grew up this way, where any kind of joy or especially physical sensations of well-being that arose were bordering on being sinful. You're not supposed to have those kinds of feelings at all. So I kind of stood up straight and I said, I told her, it's completely appropriate and fine for you to experience joy. That's what I did with my authority. So sometimes it's helpful even to tune in to the subtlest of sense of well-being. I mean, I know it can be miserable here sometimes, and being miserable is not a mistake. It can be quite hard, and you know, I think that anything that happens on retreat is not a mistake. It's fine. It's okay. So don't worry about it, but keep practicing. The trick is to keep practicing with it, and but even with if there's a lot of misery, it's also okay to tune into the 1%, 2%, 5%, 10% well-being, joy, delight, ease, something that feels good that's here as well. It's nourishing. It sometimes breaks up the monolithic hold that our mind has on our misery or it's such a kind of fixation sometimes we have on our challenges and difficulties. And sometimes, not to deny it, not to pretty it over by any means, but to realize it's not the full picture, our misery. We can also kind of notice there's more going on here, and it's possible to be nourished by a sense of well-being. It's also good to develop a habit of noticing and appreciating the sense of well-being that comes as we practice because of what Lee's been talking about, because we want at some point be able to recognize and tune into the delight, the joys, the happinesses that come with practice. They're part of the path. So here in this 16 steps of Anapanasati, after being aware of the body, start tuning in a little bit. Start recognizing what feels good in you. And then recognize and feel your mental activities, the mental constructs. I think of it like the activities of the mind. So like thinking is one of those, right? That you think a lot. But there's other ones as well. And this has been something that's been very important for me to learn to do. And so the instructions are of the Buddha is to experience the mental formations. And then it says, relax the mental formations. So experience them and then relax. And so this is how, like with thinking, this is what I've very helpful for me, is if I'm thinking a lot and I can't easily let go of my thinking, I'll tune in to what it feels like to be thinking. And so this idea of a location that I talked to you about a couple of days ago, finding there's a location where I'm thinking or the center where it seems to be, the energy of it is, or there's some corollary in the body that's connected to my thinking. Thinking is really strong. Sometimes there's these tentacles that seem to reach out, or like puppet strings that reach out from the thinking center, and they start pulling my different muscles. You know, the shoulders go up, and they pull on my forehead, and they make a frown, and pulls in my belly, and all kinds of great things, you know, like a little puppet, you know. And the strings that are thinking, and it's kind of, you know, a little bit humbling to see how much we're being directed by the puppet master. And so then, but then so to feel the physical corollary that goes along with thinking. So for me, sometimes I'll feel pressure or tension in the center of my skull, it's a little behind the forehead and somewhere in the back. Various places I feel it. And maybe there's a lot of blood flowing there, maybe there is almost like tension. I don't know why I feel tension in there or pressure, but that's what it feels like. And so I call it my thinking muscle. And just like I would relax a muscle, I'll take a breath and then I'll relax the thinking muscle. And I found that very important to do, because if I let go of thoughts and the pressure to think stays intact, the thinking muscle will just pump out more thoughts. And I can let go of thoughts until I turn blue, and it's just going to, more and more is going to come. But if the underlying factory for thinking, if the pressure or the energy that's kind of supporting thinking is met, felt, and softened, then I'm not so prone to think so much. So it's not always easy to kind of tune in and feel the physical corollary, the physical kind of connection to thinking, but probably the calmer and quieter you get, the more able you are to notice when you have a really good bout of thinking. So get yourself really, really quiet and be on the lookout for a good bout of thinking. It'll come along someday. You know, and so I've sat here in the meditation halls and minding my own business, feeling pretty good, and I can go to 0 to 60 in terms of thinking, speed of thinking, you know, faster than a Porsche. You know, and so the energy changes, and it's fascinating to watch where my center of energetic balance is. I can sit and be calm and centered. It's kind of like I finally settle down, and my center of gravity, center of beingness somehow is in my belly and down here. And then I have that really good thought. Like I think about I was jilted by my first girlfriend. And suddenly my center of energetic gravity is up in my head. It's quite something to watch that transition. So being really calm is a great advantage to see how these things work. And so because you can start noticing the difference and noticing where the energy is, where the tension is, and all this. So to notice the mental constructs, the pressure, the tension that's involved, the activity, the energy that's around all our mental processes and activities, and then take time to relax, soften, open. Maybe it's in small little increments. Just relax, settle back. Don't make a big deal of it. Don't be in opposition to it. Don't fight it, but soften. An image that helps me is the image like a mountain lake, very calm, peaceful lake. And I imagine that this thinking muscle, I flatten it out, spread it out horizontally to all sides. Somehow that image helps something inside to kind of quiet down and spread out. I have no idea if what I do in my images works for many of you, but it doesn't have to work for everyone, but for those of you who do, maybe it's interesting. But the Buddha said, you know, relax the mental constructs. That's part of the instruction. So first you get to know it, and then you relax it. First you spend time to get to know it. Take your time. Oh, this is what this energy of thinking feels like. This is where the tension is, the tightness is. This is where the puppet master is pulling in the muscles. This is what it's like. And then once you know it, once you feel like you've kind of really kind of acknowledged it well, then can you relax and soften? You can be softening the belly, shoulders. One of the interesting ideas in practice or in life is that some of the problems we have don't have to be solved. It's good enough for them to be dissolved. So we don't have to fix anything, but the whole sense of having a problem can kind of soften and fade away. And so let things dissolve, relax, soften. So the next step in this process is to then experience or feel the mind. And here what they meant by the mind, I believe, is the overall mind state. The overall sense of, so not the particular mental activities, but the overall, kind of like the mood of the mind, the state of consciousness that we're in. And, you know, it's kind of like if you see someone walking down the street who's really angry, you kind of sense a mood like dark clouds over the person, and it's not coming and going. It's like it's heavy. Or you see someone's really light and happy, and you kind of feel a mood of happiness kind of spreading from the person. So what's the general mood or quality of your mental state itself? Is it contracted or is it expanded? Contracted or expanded? An interesting, again, thing to explore, to recognize when it happens. If you have a nice bout of being really relaxed and open, the mind feels spacious, and it's maybe somewhat clear, expanded, or quiet, and you're going along just fine. And then again, a really good thought comes along. You know, something that really kind of grabs you and pulls you in, and you're like there, high school. How could she? When you've noticed you've kind of been pulled into the high school stories, and you know, duking it out 40 years later, what's happened to the quality of your mental state, the overall kind of state of consciousness? And some people report that it gets really constricted and small. It's like the range in which the kind of the area in which the mind is, it's got really small and tight. It's like preoccupied in a small little thing. Some people will report that it turns dark. If they really notice, one was more light, and now it's really dark. You know, it's like the darkness set in. And so, what's the difference like to have to be not caught in thought and to be caught in thought? So this is good news for you. Because if it should happen over the next days that you get caught in thoughts, if that, you know, accidentally should happen, then it's good. Take it as a good thing, because you get to study, you get to feel and sense what's this like to be constricted. What changes? How does the state of mind, the quality of mind, change? So we start noticing the quality of the mind. And one of the qualities of the mind is that as we begin relaxing the mental formations, all this activity quiets down a little bit, the general tendency is this state of the mind to become better. People usually appreciate the sense of being expanded, like the sense of awareness has now become bigger than the head. It's kind of open and expansive. Some kind of sense of being translucent, clear is there, easeful, some people feeling a more peaceful quality of mind, peaceful. And so it's kind of start noticing. If you can notice that starts happening, then it says, and that feels good. Feel the goodness of that. And here the word is pamoja, is feel the gladness. Allow yourself to feel how it's nice, it's good to have a mind like this. All the good states that arise in meditation are nourished by our appreciation of it, provided the appreciation does not have clinging as part of it. Something to hold on to, or we don't take it too personally or use it to define ourselves. But it's okay to appreciate it. So here it says, feel the mind, feel the delight of it, and then the quality of your mental state is one of the most precious resources you have, one of the most beautiful things you can have. And so as you get aware of this, stabilize it, settle it. And the actual instructions here is to concentrate. But concentrate is a little bit dangerous word in English. I like the word compose yourself, settle yourself, gather yourself together around it. Begin to steady the mind, still the mind. And then in that steady and stillness of the mind, then it doesn't say relax now, but it says liberate. When experiences or knows the mind, it's liberated. And usually people who comment on this text say it doesn't mean ultimate liberation. It just it's to notice that you've actually had to release some things to attain this level of concentration. So Lee talked about abandoning the hindrances. And it helps to know that you've abandoned hindrances so that you can feel the joy of that, the delight of that. Start appreciating the experience of release. Appreciate letting go. As you settle into a deeper state of concentration, a lot of it has to do with letting go. And so appreciate that letting go, that process of release. And then the text goes on, and now it moves into the insight practices. So first the body, then the mental activities, then the mental state are all kind of practiced with. We practice with the body, we get connected to our body, we stay with our body, we get let the body be a foundation, a support for us. Then we have the mental activities, we begin bring them into harmony, we settle them, we calm them down, we gather them together so they work more for the for purposes of practice. And then we start appreciating that part of all this is our overall mental state that we're in, the overall mental quality of the mood or the quality of awareness that's there. And we begin appreciating that there is a, you know, in Zen they call it big mind, expanded mind, peaceful mind, calm mind that's there. And then as we steady that, steady ourselves into it, there's release, letting go more. And a lot of the letting go is kind of happens on its own. We settle in, and so much wonderful things drop away, and it's nice. And then, as it's been said, when the mind is somewhat steadied, steady and clear and open, then we're in a very good position for insight to arise. And there are different schools of how insight occurs. Sometimes you go looking for it, particular instructions to go look, and sometimes you just practice until it comes to you, it gets revealed. And one of the core insights is the insight into impermanence. There's something very significant about seeing the arising and passing of phenomena. To see it on all kinds of different scales, but in particular when the mind is really concentrated, to see the arising and passing of phenomena at the most smallest time scale as possible. So that everything that we're experiencing is made up of sense data. That I think, as Lee said, that we take in the sense data and we organize it, didn't you say this? Into concepts and ideas. That's the next talk. I'm setting you up. Preparing the audience. I'm in the warm-up band. And so we often live in the world of concepts and ideas and gross ideas. I shouldn't use the word gross, it's two meanings, I guess. Large kind of conceptual ideas of self and others and what we need and what has to happen and all this. And we live in our stories. But it's part of the advantage of getting a quiet, still, concentrated mind is we finally kind of free ourselves from all the stories we're telling ourselves. Stories are generally overrated. And so we, and then kind of when we start getting to the basic way in which our experiences, the building blocks of our experience, we see them arising and passing. There's something that begins happening where we realize that, it's not that interesting to cling to it anymore. Maybe you can't cling to it. And so there starts to be a process, the tradition calls it fading away. And I love this. I love the expression "fading away," because it's not the Big Bang, you know, like just suddenly it's gone. Many things just kind of I find just kind of go slowly away. The thinking mind itself sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it just doesn't turn off just like that. Sometimes you practice, and it gets fainter and fainter, weaker and weaker, till finally maybe when the thinking mind or some of the mental activities are really faint, they kind of just evaporate finally. And we just take our time, let this process of fading away happen. And at some point, there's an experience of the absence of clinging, the absence of these stories that we live in. And so to experience that absence, the Buddha called it cessation, to allow ourselves to recognize and see that here now something meaningful has ceased. Maybe it's a temporary ceasing, but it's ceasing of identification of self, ceasing of our stories, ceasing of comparing ourselves to other people, ceasing of always looking into the future for our happiness, ceasing, stopping, ending of always lookout and searching for security, ceasing of always reviewing the past, and ceasing of always being afraid, ceasing of always being resentful and angry, or that something really ceases, comes to an end. And to know that that's possible, to really know the ending of certain things, even temporarily, to know that we don't have to be stuck forever. It's not essential to who we are. It's not our true nature to be clinging, to be stuck, to be attached. It's not our true nature to have, you know, all this stuff there. Because we've experienced the cessation. And cessation happens in small little steps, and it can happen in big ways. And then the last step is the relaxation step. Remember, it's each of these ways ends with relaxation. And here the word is relinquishment. So these 16 steps are four tetrads. The first first one ends with relaxing the body. The second ends with relaxing the mental formations. The third is releasing or liberating the mind. The fourth is ends with relinquishment. And I'm not sure what exactly the Pali should mean, but at least how I like to interpret the English of relinquishment, it's not just a matter of release, not a matter of letting go, but it involves wisdom that, yes, I'll let go, and I give up my commitment to that again. So this is not wise to pick this up again. I'm finished with this. I'm finished. I'm done. You always want people to like you, which was my big hang-up for years. At some point, I was just sick and tired of the effort it took to get people to like me. And I give up, in the best senses of the term. Relinquished. I'm done with that, more or less. And it's easier to want to relinquish or to have the wisdom to relinquish. Or you have certain addiction, or you have a certain addiction to self, you know, always proving yourself or being the right person or hiding, pulling back. So finally, I'm done with that. So it's kind of, I'm done. Enough of that. Enough of chasing whatever I was chasing in my life. I'm done. So the relinquishment is a deeper movement. It's kind of a commitment. It's a wisdom. It's understanding. It's like, you know, I'm finished. Because it's enough. Enough of that. So maybe there are times when it'll be useful for you to tune into your body, recognize what's happening, feel it, and relax. Maybe there are times when it's useful to tune in to the mental activities that are going on, and feel it, sense it, get to know it, and relax it, soften. If you can't relax it, sometimes you can soften around it. Your attitude you have towards it can soften. Sometimes at time, it might be nice to notice the general state of mind you're in, the quality of awareness. in a kind of more spacious way in which awareness can be there, kind of this field of knowing, field of awareness. And you can tune into it and feel it, get to know it, and then perhaps you can let go into it. You can let go of what interferes with it. You can let go of what keeps it constrained or small or tight. Let go. And from time to time, you can become aware of how things arise and pass, the changing nature of things. And in seeing the changing nature of things, and how things come and go, and nothing stays the same, there can be a wisdom can arise that you realize it's not really worth clinging to this, and begin fading away, the fading away of our thirsting, our craving, our clinging, and all the different forms. It slowly begins to wear away, to settle away. We let go of it little step by step. Until the day comes when some clinging, some craving, some resistance, some way we're told held tight, ceases, ends, stops, and we have an experience of ourselves without it. It's very precious to have that experience. Oh, I don't have to be this way. And then saying, you know, I think I want to be done with this. I think I want to relinquish. I'm done. And I think it's a very significant, mature movement to see and understand deeply enough and make a choice. I'm done. Enough. Enough with this. Not out of aversion. Not out of any kind of aversion or ill will or, you know, it's enough. Don't have to do that anymore. Recognize, feel, relax. And then nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. For which one? Oh, I have no idea. Sorry. So, let's sit for a couple of minutes, and if you want, you could try it out.